Hi, everybody. This is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome to the Abbott Talks podcast. Over the past few years, the world has come to recognize Abbott as a company dedicated to helping people live happier and healthier lives. In this podcast series, we'll talk with the healthcare leaders, the executives, and the engineers who are working every day to develop new technologies to help people live their best lives. I know you'll enjoy this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. All right, this is Tom Salemi of Device Talks. Welcome back to the Abbott Talks podcast. We've got a really great med tech conversation for you today. I spoke with Matthew Fischler. He's the Director of Systems Engineering at Abbott, and he's the Chief Architect for Abbott's leadless platform. And we talked about Aveir. Talked, of course, about his story, how he got into medtech, what drew him into the industry, and what's kept him here. He has spent some time both in the startup world and the corporate world, and he'll tell some great stories about the work that went into developing Abbott's dual-chamber leadless pacemaker. Very cool platform, very cool story, and really grateful to Matthew Fischler for joining us. Of course, before we begin this episode, I'd like to welcome our sponsor and thank our sponsor, ProMed, for sponsoring this episode of Abbott Talks. You can find out more about ProMed at their website, promedmolding.com. I am here speaking with Brian Riley. Brian's a director of sales and marketing at ProMed. Brian, tell us about ProMed.
Happy to. ProMed is a contract manufacturer located in the Twin Cities, just west of Minneapolis. We've been around since 1989, so we're just about going on 35 years here. Most of the services we provide are with molding components. And with that said, silicone chemistries, high purity plastics. We also provide assemblies, final device manufacturing, and packaging and testing if that's what's required. I'd say the majority of work that we support, in fact, upwards of 90% of the business that we have today is in the medical device arena. And with that said, I'd say the majority of that is in the long-term implantable space, as well as the drug delivery space. So it's a big part of what we do, and it's not only a strength, but it's our core competency. Other areas where we support projects is in other highly regulated industries. So some good examples there might be in the aerospace and defense industries or the electronics industries and even in the automotive arena.
Well, that's great. We'll hear more from ProMed a little later in the podcast. Once again, if you want to find out more information now, go to promedmolding.com. Well, Matthew Fischler, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
We're going to be talking a bit about Aveir and the many amazing things it can do and about your leadless platform overall at Abbott. But as always, as everyone who listens to these podcasts know, we need to find out about our guests first and how they found their way into this great industry. Matthew, what led you to a medtech career?
I think I was always interested in medtech in some form or another. Even when I was a kid, I loved medicine, and I love building things. and I didn't know it back then, but that, you know, was medtech in a sense. And
I was going to say there was no real. I grew up around the same time you did, yeah. And the word medtech never came up in any table, any supper conversations or anything like that.
No, but you know, I always wished, I always dreamed about being a doctor.
Oh, neat.
You know, from when I was 8 or earlier, I was always, you know, back when we had CB radios, if you remember.
Now you're talking.
Now I'm going way back for the engineers. My handle, literally was the doctor. So,
oh, nice. Yeah. All right.
So that was.
I was monkey wrench.
Oh,
so that was
okay.
Maybe we talked once or twice on our CB radio.
So. Yeah.
Some people are smiling at this. Some people are
scratching their head.
But so, when did you decide to disappoint everyone and not be a doctor, and why?
So I went into college still thinking I was going to be a doctor, and like somewhere in my freshman sophomore year, I went in as a biomedical engineer and a computer science major, And I love the biomedical engineering. I was just fascinated by it and consumed by it, really, especially the bioelectricity courses and stuff around bioelectricity, electrophysiology were really intriguing to me. And so I sort of was changing my thinking about, well, I really love medicine, but I really, really, really love the engineering behind the medicine. And so I changed my focus from medicine MD to quote unquote medicine PhD. Mm-hmm. And so I went that track.
So what did that involve? I'm trying to place the time. So this would be what, early 90s?
Yeah, keep going back.
Oh, yeah? Okay. So what was around you at the time that you were pointing to? What companies were around? What was kind of really, what was the Olympus that you wanted to climb?
I did college in the, let's say, the mid 80s. Graduated 88. And
I'm just a few years behind. Yeah. So just 3 years behind you, so that's fine.
You know, the company, I wasn't thinking about companies. I didn't have a dream company I was going to join or anything of that sort. I was really still just thinking about the technology. I didn't care where it was going to be. And so for me, it was, I wanted to delve deeper, really much deeper into the biomedical engineering aspect of medicine. And so in, you know, graduate, I applied to a bunch of graduate programs, ended up at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine, which was a really amazing experience because the first year that I was there for all of the BME PhD students was first year of medical school. Like, we were really part of the class, and so we got the full experience of that first year of medicine. But it gave a great foundation for everything else that I've done since.
So what was your first job in medtech? Where did you find your footing?
After a very long PhD process, I actually ended up getting hired by a company called Ventratex, which was one of the major implantable cardio defibrillator companies back in the 90s. So that got me out from the East Coast to the West Coast, and you know, I was brought into Ventratex in really kind of a heavy R, less so development, more of the research side, and my interests were understanding how that electric shock from the defibrillation interacted with the underlying electrophysiology of the fibrillation to either, you know, to result in a successful defibrillation. And I spent 5 years doing that.
So did you get a feeling at the time, and I'm looking at your LinkedIn profile, it said 95 to 97. I mean, that was a time when, you know, biotechs were going public, medical device companies were going public. There was a lot of enthusiasm. It wasn't .com. It wasn't what was going to happen on the tech side. But there was a lot of, I don't know, the industry was emerging for startups and for entrepreneurs, and it became something really, really special and really exciting that people like yourself could latch onto and dream of starting a product and building a company around it. Did you kind of feel that excitement at the time that you kind of hitching your wagon to something that was going to go?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I mean, especially in the cardiac space, it was that was like the premier time. There was a lot of technology that was being brought to benefit patients, and it was a great time to be in the space. I came out at a perfect time, I felt.
And I was looking at your profile again. I saw some names. I'm like, I remember that company, Paracore, CyberHeart, all these cool companies, Cavu Medical. I remember I was covering venture capital at the time, so I remember running all these financing stories. I saw that Ventratex was acquired by St. Jude. Did you spend some time at St. Jude? And what brought you back to the startup world?
St. Jude acquired VentureTex in the end of 97. I stayed for another 2+ years. And then I was interested in kind of opening my wings again. So I actually left for a year, got my MBA, and then I wanted to do something different. I was feeling a little pigeonholed in the research world, and I wanted to be more engaged in the development side. And so that's how I came back and really wanted dabbled in the startups for a long time.
Did you, in the research world, do you feel as if you don't have your hand sort of on the business side of things, that you're only kind of carrying the ball so far upfield? Is that sort of the frustration? Or I shouldn't say there is a frustration. I put a word in about, but
it wasn't a frustration. I guess it was more of a personal frustration or feeling like I was tapping out in terms of my contributions, especially within in the area. And the concept of defibrillation was maturing at that point. There was a little sort of diminishing returns in the type of research I was exploring. And I had all these other ideas I really wanted to explore personally to contribute more on the development side and the patient facing mm-hmm. side.
Do you, when asked by a young engineer about it, who may be interested in an MBA, do you recommend that path?
I guess I would ask why they're doing it. For me, it was, I had visions of doing business development in the medical tech fields, and then that was a really bad time to be getting my MBA and coming out, because that was the worst time mm-hmm. in terms of VC funding for the area. But I think if you use it as a stepping stone to expand your understanding of business in general and how people interact in general, marketing, the larger business aspects, that's been for me the most valuable mm-hmm. Learnings from that year.
So what was how would you describe your time at the startups? Did you enjoy that sort of lifestyle?
Loved it. Yeah. I guess I'm, for better or for worse, I'm sort of a workaholic at heart, as most startup people either are or choose to be. I love just the concept of inventing new things, coming up, understanding or realizing a problem and ideating from all directions to come up with, a bunch of different possible solutions. And then, as a team, kind of working through those possible solutions to hopefully the right solution, the best solution.
So did you spend your entire career? It looks like you spent your entire career in cardiac, in pacemakers or cardiac more broadly?
Cardiac more broadly, except for CAVU was not cardiac. It was GI. But other than that, it was all cardiac.
What do you, as an engineer, what excites you about working in that space and the heart, other than a critical piece of machinery for the body, but just as design challenges, I'm sure it presents some intriguing challenges.
Yeah, I'm fascinated by how this electromechanical lump of tissue works in such a coordinated fashion to really sustain us, to sustain everything, where we are. And so for me, it was also really amazing how the math of it all worked. Mm. There was a certain beauty to that math underlying, or at least we could reduce into math. And so from when I was reducing, looking through that math and then trying to reframe it into, you know, for patients who's have issues, how do you get back to that beauty and get them back to a healthy situation?
I love that. No, I love, you're right. There's a real magic to the heart and how it works, and to be able to kind of break it down into it being a math problem or a math solution is exciting. All right, well, I hope you're enjoying this conversation with Matthew Fischler of Abbott, but we're going to take a quick minute to visit with our sponsor, ProMed. Once again, I'm speaking with Brian Riley. Brian's Director of Sales and Marketing at ProMed. Brian, tell me, how does ProMed work with medical device companies?
Of course. ProMed typically supports the OEM's innovative ideas. We provide services and level of expertise that they might not necessarily possess in-house. I always like to think of it as we're an extension of their R&D. In some cases, the companies we work with don't have R&D in-house, and that's one of the big reasons why they reach out to somebody like ourselves. I know it sounds a bit cliche, but I often use the term concept to commercialization, because that's essentially what we do. We support them at the front end, at the prototype stage, all the way through development into the production stage, or in their case, having a commercialized product on the market. ProMed is a mid-sized company. We're about 325 employees. We're also privately owned. I mention this because I believe that one of the benefits that we offer our customers is the fact that they have direct access to our leadership team. In my opinion, this often streamlines the decision-making process on both ends. It also enables our customers to form these relationships with our leadership that can evolve into deep-rooted relationships and connections. We're in it for the long haul. We're not in it for any short-term wins here.
And Brian, do you have any new services or news that you can share with our listeners?
We do. We've recently collaborated with the silicone formulators, and we've supported each other in the design of both electrically conductive silicones as well as silicone foams to accommodate the unique requirements that we require for processing these types of formulations and the performance that our customers require. So what's exciting about this is everyone knows that silicones are great insulators, but they're not conductive, but you can certainly make them conductive by adding conductive fillers. So that's provided a lot of new solutions that traditionally didn't exist for our customers and the devices that they're designing. In other news, and this is fresh, hot off the press here, but we've secured a location in San Jose, Costa Rica for a new manufacturing facility. And we anticipate breaking ground here this quarter. We believe it'll be about an 18-month project to get the building underway. And we're estimating that it will be open for manufacturing in Q1 of 2026. So this is really exciting because not only does it provide us access to great resources in regards to technology and localized customers, but it's also going to enable us to support both existing and new projects that we have underway.
Wow, that's great news on the groundbreaking, Brian. Congratulations. I understand you have some other really interesting news to report.
We do. The pharma side of our business had a recent acquisition with a really exciting biodegradable microparticle technology. And so this type of formulation is going to broadly open their capabilities to service our customers in the drug delivery arena. A lot of the projects that this can support, some examples might be ophthalmic diseases, providing cancer therapies. There's various women's health applications where this can help support, as well as cardiovascular and neuromodulation type of therapies. We're really excited to see what this is going to do for our customers. Finally, in other news, I'll mention that we've recently invested heavily in automated solutions. We have a new cell at our facility in Plymouth, and these automated cells can accommodate processing and molding, inspection, and even packaging. This can help support very high volume projects that don't necessarily require a lot of manual secondary operations. So it's going to open up a lot of avenues for us that traditionally didn't exist for ProMed.
Final question, Brian. How do you see the industry changing in the future?
From where I sit, what I see is our customers are constantly looking for increased value without compromising quality. Recent trends that I've seen from some of the larger OEMs is the need for consolidation of vendors. And a good example of this adaptability, I'll call it, a few years back, we were approached by a major CRM company looking to design a new drug-eluting steroid collar. the project entailed not only just blending in an API with a silicone formulation and molding a component. It was much more complex than that. We had to develop methodology to track and trend the elution profile through in vitro testing. We had to look at the purity assays of the drug, tent uniformity, as well as drug degradation profiles. All of these, I'll call them secondary supporting services that went into making this project successful, was really the genesis behind ProMed Pharma. And these services still exist today. So I just feel like it's a great example of our agility and our willingness to pivot. And that's really how I believe we define the level of customer service that we provide everybody.
All right, well, those are some great thoughts. Thank you, Brian, for joining us on the podcast. Thank you, ProMed, for sponsoring this episode of Abbott Talks. Once again, if you'd like to find out more information about ProMed, go to its website, promedmolding.com. So you joined St. Jude in 2014. Was that the was that an acquisition by NanoStim?
I'm trying to remember that. Yeah. So I spent, a dozen years in startups, and one of those startups, the last startup, was NanoStim. And so I kind of got brought back into the St. Jude fold through that acquisition. And then, of course, St. Jude Medical got acquired by Abbott.
That's exciting. So let's talk about your time now at Abbott. Give us a sense of your responsibilities there. It sounds like you're overseeing a lot of the development of what's going on in the leadless platform.
Correct. So I was specifically brought in to as part of the transition from NanoStim into St. Jude. You know, the founders of NanoStim were moving on to other pastures, and so I was brought in to take the reins of that program, and specifically to take it to the next level. In 2014, we kicked off our dual chamber development effort. Mm. You know, and it was from scratch. And we kind of thought, well, let's see if we can come up with a solution to get to a true dual chamber leadless system.
So help me understand the importance of a dual chamber, having a dual chamber device. What does it enable you to do that wasn't previously available? And I'll ask secondly about leadless, and if you want to build all of that into one answer, you can. But why is dual chamber important?
In the cardiac space, you know, patients will have certain arrhythmia issues. They can either exist just in the lower chambers, the ventricles, but more often than not, they will involve the upper chambers, the atrial chambers, or both, or the interactions between the two. And so, the single chamber devices are devices that will provide therapy to a single chamber. So usually it's the ventricular chambers, and that's generally about 10-15% of the overall population that requires pacemaker support. So the vast majority of patients really need both upper and lower chamber support. So this is where this dual chamber pacemaker comes in, where it can provide the therapy needed within the atrial chambers and the ventricular chambers and maintain the right timing between the two.
That's interesting. So, and I'll go into leadless in a moment, but what are the challenges of the dual chambers? Because you're in different chambers, but you're still in the heart. So there has to be coordination between the two. And how do you do that? Because that sounds amazing.
Right. So for decades, the conventional pacemakers, let's call them conventional pacemakers, is a single device that's implanted up in the shoulder area, and there are leads, wires that are run down into the heart, and there'll generally be one that's run into the right ventricle, and another separate wire, separate lead that run into the right atrium. But they're all running back to this one pacemaker device. So you have one brain, and it can take the information, the signals coming from both of those leads, both those chambers, to make decisions on whether it needs to pace or whether it needs to just listen, you know, things are going all right. And it does all the timing decisions in that one device. In the leadless world, we don't have a single device. We don't even have leads. The whole concept is we have a device that's so small and self-contained that it can be implanted directly into the cardiac chamber. And the first generation of leadless devices were single chamber ventricular leadless devices. That was the NanoStim device, and others have done similar. And that's fine because you have one chamber, one device, one brain. It can do one thing. The challenge is, how do you do that in a leadless platform when your one device is only in one chamber? How do you get information from the other chamber? So our approach was, well, we're going to have another device placed in the right atrium. And then these devices are going to communicate on a B2B basis wirelessly, so that they can coordinate their functionality as though they were a single system. And that's the basis and the foundation of our implant-to-implant, eye-to-eye communication. That foundation of communicating through the blood and tissue provides the ability for these two devices to communicate and maintain coordination to provide true dual chamber functionality.
So when that idea was first written on a whiteboard somewhere, is like, this is what we need to do. I feel like we're in mission control and like, look, this is, we need to get to the moon, figure out how to get there. What was it like when that was where that you knew that was the objective and that's where you go? Did you have a clear path in your mind? Like, oh, this, we just need to do X, Y, and Z to get there. Or was this very much kind of a moon program? Or like, we're going to iterate here and iterate there and iterate there until we get to where we need to go.
Yeah, this was really a moonshot program. We didn't have a clear vision that we could do it at all. And from many different layers, first was, we didn't even know what the first question was, how are we going to communicate between the two devices? What technology would we use? There's traditional communication technologies like Bluetooth or, you know, radio frequency, Wi-Fi. I mean, you name it. There are existing technologies, but they require a relatively large amount of power or energy to operate. And the idea of doing that on every single cardiac cycle, which is, you know, hundreds of millions of cycles potentially, became prohibitive. So we had to invent a new way of doing it. And so we came up with an approach of utilizing what we had already, which were, we had devices pace. That means they generate electrical impulses. And so we devised a means of using electrical impulses, packaging them into a packet of information and transmitting that to the other device, and then having the other device receive that. So we're utilizing the existing electrodes that are already in the device. We're existing a lot of the electronics that are in the device, and leveraging a lot what we had. And it became a lot more energy possible. But there was still a whiteboard concept. And so we had to go through a lot of steps to prove it to ourselves that it was even possible, even feasible. So that brings us to a really interesting, fun story, actually. In part of this, we developed test chips to test this idea. Is it going to work or not? And we packaged these pretty crudely into what we called submarines, which are really crude packages that we could put into a fish tank filled with saline. And we then said go, and we tried to, and we see to see if these chest chips can communicate with each other at different distances. And that was our very first experience with eye-to-eye communication. And I remember we were all standing there. I was like dumbfounded that we saw these messages pinging back and forth between these submarines and this
amazing
fish tank.
This is like a Thomas Edison. Exactly. A Thomas Edison moment.
Yeah.
So from that point to what, and just so I just want to back up. So if I understand that the information that needs to be communicated between these two is being communicated through the electricity that they generate, that the
packets of electrical impulses. Yep.
What is powering the devices?
They have a battery.
Okay.
With a small battery, each device itself in total is smaller than a AAA battery. It's about a third. It's smaller than a AAA battery. And within that, there's like 3/4 of that is battery. And it's a high density, a capacity that gives us enough power to pace and sense and communicate.
So what was the process after the submarine experiment in the tank of saline to developing the device?
Yep.
How much time passed and describe, if you will, just sort of the what went into all of that?
Sure. So we spent the better part of a year before we even got to that point, working out just the fundamentals of the concept. Once we established that, then the next layer of the eye-to-eye communication protocol was, how are these devices going to communicate information so that they would operate as a system? So we had to develop a protocol of sharing this information. So what goes into these packets? And so we designed the protocol layer to where each device on a pace or sense event would communicate essentially this packet saying, hey, I paced or I sensed, and it will also convey some other information if relevant, like maybe here's a new pacing rate that we should be using, or I just detected AMS, which is a fast rhythm in the atrium, or hey, I detected a magnet. Is it being applied? Things that the devices need to share between each other.
Wow. So how does it feel once you sort of get that knowledge and that insights and that work into a product? And let's kind of fast forward a bit toward going to the FDA and getting approval. I mean, it's probably a long road in between those two moments, but what's it feel like when something that started out with these two submarines in a fish tank, which didn't even start out there, that was a year into it, into an actual FDA approved medical device? What is that feeling like for someone who's in on the early design of a device like this?
Well, in short, it's awesome. I think it was a really long road, but we didn't think it was going to be quick either. We wanted to be really deliberate about it, and it was blazing new ground. It was a breakthrough technology. No one had ever done it. There was no commercial products out there that are having two independent devices in the body communicating essentially real time. So we're doing brand new things. And so we wanted to do it right. And we wanted to make sure it was going to be safe and certainly effective. So we took our time with it. And I think we're reaping the rewards of that diligence now that, you know, it's approved and being implanted in patients.
So it's been out for, it was approved about a year ago. It's been on the market for about that length. Yep. Any, I know you're on the engineering side, but do you have any sort of updates on how the launch is going, or at least what's your sense of things after being out a year?
Yeah, I mean, I don't know a lot of the specifics. I do know that we're, you know, as much as we were deliberate before it got approved, we're also, you know, as a company being deliberate about how we're getting it out to the customers and to the patients. So we don't want to rush it. We don't want to, you know, trip over our own feet, so to speak. And so, you know, we're making sure we're training the users, the clinicians, so that they use it properly. They understand the new technology so that they can be effective in applying it to their patients. That being said, I understand it's the ramp up is going well and it's being well received.
So where is your attention now? I mean, you've got this platform, the I2I, which is the letter I, the number two, the letter I, implant to implant. This to me feels like a platform that can be used in other parts of the body. It could be used in other heart device, maybe. What's the plan for the future for CRM and maybe other medical devices?
I mean, I think we envision that it can be leveraged in many ways. I would say that we're still working through where and how we're going to leverage it. So there's nothing specific that's, I guess I could share to exactly where those might go. But we also recognize that it has a lot of value in leveraging it in many different ways. And we want to be able to do that.
Yeah. So going back to the beginning of your story, I mean, being a young person who had dreams of designing devices that would save lives, I mean, what would that young person say today, you know, knowing what you're accomplishing? How do you feel about working on this project? You've worked on a number of great projects. I'm sure you have pride in all of them, but this would feel like something extra special, I would think.
It is. I mean, you know, as we talked, you know, I touched a lot of startups along my career path, and many of them didn't make it to commercialization, you know, and to some extent, I'm proud of everything, all the engineering and work that went into it, but sort of at the end, sort of sad that it never really made it to the light of day.
Yeah.
And here's one that succeeded. And not only that, is really succeeding in a major way. So I, you know, the satisfaction and the joy and of seeing it going to out there to patients, to being actually talking to patients and clinicians and getting personal feedback on how their experiences have been with it, is so gratifying. It you know, looking back, you know, if I was talking to myself 30 years ago, I was like, you know, keep going, man. it's out there.
Maybe you can get a CB radio that can transmit through time and talk to the young person.
Sounds like a movie.
Yeah, right. You brought up the startup thing, and I want to close up on this, but do you think a project like this would have succeeded on a startup level, or did it just require too much investment and time without having, you know, a board of directors kind of checking in with you every month and without having the need to sort of achieve milestones? Can something like this be done at a startup level, or is this sort of moonshot program exclusive to a larger OEM like Abbott that has the resources and to put behind it and achieve maybe a broader vision?
I think the startup could take it to a certain level.
Yeah.
As you know, I guess this is my personal perspective on the CRM world. I think it's really hard to take a CRM product as a startup company out commercialized, and not because they couldn't necessarily, but it's probably the dynamics of the healthcare industry as a whole has changed.
Yeah.
And needs that larger base of, you know, of a company to help with that. So I would say nowadays it's probably a partnership.
Interesting. All right. Well, it's a cool story. I mean, it's nice to have someone who had spent their life, you know, with an idea in mind and then having them finally achieve that goal. And I really appreciate your taking some time and joining us on the podcast.
Yeah, I really enjoyed speaking to you.
Well, that is a wrap. Thanks so much for joining us on this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. Thanks again to ProMed for sponsoring. Once again, you can go to their website, promedmolding.com, for more information. Really enjoyed meeting and talking with Matthew Fischler. Thank you, Matthew, for joining us. And of course, thanks again to you, our listeners, for making these podcasts what they are. We really do appreciate your support. If you could subscribe to the Device Talks Podcast Network so you don't miss a future episode, that would be a great help. Please tell your friends and family about the podcast. The more people listening, the better. I don't often ask for reviews, but please do review the podcast on your podcast player. Give us as many stars as you think is fair. We'd love to get the word out. That helps get the word out, and we'd love to get the word out to other potential listeners. Finally, share this on social media, and when you do, connect with me. We'd love to be part of your network, Tom Salemi at Device Talks. You can also tag me, tag Device Talks, tag Mass Device, and of course, tag Abbott as well. I'm sure they'd like to see what you're posting. All right, folks, thanks again for joining us on this episode of the Abbott Talks podcast. We're already working on our next episode. We'll be sending that out to you real soon. Take care, everybody.